welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to Christopher Sykes, the biographer of David Hockney, who has just died at 88. And Christopher wrote two terrific volumes about the life of David Hockney. Christopher, I was struck by, with Hockney, of course he was a genius, but with my limited dealings with him, he was also seemed to be very funny and good company, which geniuses often aren't. Is that right?
Yes. He was excellent company. He had such a marvellous sense of humour. I think, actually it was very recently, I read somewhere that some interviewer asked him what was the secret of him being keeping so young. And he said, having a good laugh twice a day. And I think that says a lot about him. He had such a wonderful laugh. He was very funny.
And tell me about your biography. You approached him to write it?
Yes, I'd been just done a book on Eric Clapton, and I was looking for a new project, but I wanted to do something to use the skills I'd learned from working with Clapton, which was interviewing, how to interview people. So I wanted to do someone who was alive. And I knew David a bit, and I then was rather surprised to see that there was no biography of him, other than some very bad book written in the 1970s. And so I approached him. First of all, I rang my agent and said, do you think it's a good idea? And he said, yes. So I said, OK, well, I'll go and ask him. And so I asked him, plucked up the courage and said, would you ever let me write your biography? And he said, I'll let you know in a couple of months. So I waited 2 months and I asked him again. Ask me again in 3 months. And this went on for about a year and a half. And then one day, I mean, after like 6 encounters like that, I went to see him and I said, look, the thing is, David, I've got to get on with my life. And so can you just give me a straight answer? Will you let me write your biography? And he said, all right, you can do it. But you can do it in my time, not yours. And then it was rather sweet because he then said, I said, thank you so much because, I've been wanting to get on with it and, haven't had any other work to do while I've been waiting. He said, oh, well, I understand. You like work, don't you? Like that.
Which he also did. He wrote a thing at the bottom of his bed saying something.
Yes,
is that right?
That's right. He wrote at the bottom of his bed, it said something like, get up and go to work.
And he did work, 16, 17-hour days?
Yeah, he worked all the time. I mean, his whole life was about work. That's what he did. And he had his whole life was making sure that he had the setup, so he always wanted to have like 2 assistants who were there to provide him with all the brushes he needed, make sure he had all his paint, that he had enough canvases, and he loved eating, so he wanted someone who could cook, so because he liked to have his 3 meals a day, and I mean, it was fantastic, well organised. So after sleeping, It was work, 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 and eat, eat, eat.
And he was working pretty much until the day he died.
I believe he was working right to the very end, yes, literally. But that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I haven't seen him for a few months, but his nephew told me that he was working to the very end.
And your books start at the beginning of his life in 1937, and from a very young age, it comes from the gods, this gift. He is drawing, he's drawing on the floor in his parents' house, isn't that right?
Yes, and he drew on any piece of paper he could find. So he drew on the white bits of newspaper. He drew on his comics where there wasn't any actual drawing, other drawings. Anywhere, he drew on the floor if he had to. And it was quite obvious. I mean, it was quite... His mother used to get quite irritated by the mess he made. And she wrote in one of her diaries, "What a trial it is having an artist as a son."
But she and the whole family realised at an early age how good he was, and they're always supportive, is that right?
Yes, yes. I mean, they were fantastically supportive. And that was very important to him, yeah.
And he knew from a young age how extremely good he was, did he?
I think he always had, yes, I think he had great self-confidence. I mean, if you look at, there's a rather charming drawing of his family having breakfast. And it's, you know, you can see it's very confidently drawn. And I think it was done when he was like 12. And you could see that he just had an amazing skill. I mean, drawing, that was the thing. He believed that drawing was a very important part of being an artist. You must learn to draw. And it upset him tremendously that art schools had stopped teaching students to draw. And he was probably right, I think, you know.
Yeah, and an extension of that, he talked a lot about looking. We can all look, but we don't look.
Yes, that's one of the things he taught me, one of the early lessons he taught me when I first got to know him. And he took me on a drive. I remember this so well. So we got into the car. It was an open-top car. And we were driving around in Yorkshire, near Bridlington. And after about 5 minutes, he stopped the car. And he said to me, what colour is the road? And I looked at this bit of tarmac road, and I just said, well, it's the colour of tarmac, it's sort of grey. He said, right, okay. You should look a bit more closely at it. Anyway, we'd say, on we drove, and after about 40 minutes, he stopped the car again. And he said, what colour is the road now? And I said, well, yes, I can see now. It's got blue in it, and there's some green, and flashes of yellow, and yes. So he said, you know, you have to look, you've got to use your eyes to look at things. Don't just, go around just thinking everything was there. You've got to look at it. I remember my nephews were having breakfast in my house one day, and they had pieces of paper, and they were drawing sort of aeroplanes and monsters and things. And he took the paper from me and he said, don't draw, stop drawing monsters, and you should draw what you see. And said, I want you to draw what you see. And then he gave them two bits of paper, and they started drawing what was on the table, you know.
And
he was a very good teacher, a brilliant teacher.
And our friend Lindy Dufferin, whose husband Sheridan Dufferin was an early dealer in him, said he had a genius also for assembling a picture, so he could look, say, at this room we're in now, and immediately know how to do it. Say to Lindy, it's very easy, you do this, and then you do that, and you do that.
Which is extremely difficult, as you know. I mean, I don't draw, but I know how difficult it is to start anything. It's like, well, very interesting.
And lots of people have commented since his death at his own personal exuberance, but also a sort of joy in his pictures, and that's there from very early on as well, isn't it?
I think he had a great joy of life, actually. He certainly, and he had, he had a great sense of humour. No, he took great joy in what he saw around him. I remember, funnily enough, Lindy, when she'd stayed with him, saying to me, and it's extraordinary because, you know, he lives in this house in Bridlington, and it's surrounded by just very, quite ugly council houses with dull grey roofs. But when you look at his pictures of it, he's drawn something completely different, you know. So he's given it all beauty.
And he makes these incredible reinventions, doesn't he? So his early pictures in the early 60s, like A Rake's Progress, are extremely avant-garde and progressive, aren't they?
Well, when you look at them now, they're amazing. The way he used, he used speech in his drawings, and he had numbers and all sorts of things going on in them. I mean, very, very, yes, as you say, quite avant-garde, really.
And the move to America, more particularly California, where did that come from?
Yes, well, I think that he went off to on a visit to America just to have a look, really, and was completely bewitched by the light in California, by the fact that, you know, the sun was always out, it was so bright. He loved the bright blue skies. And I just think he came back. He thought it was an artist's paradise.
Yeah. And always, from the beginning, very open about being gay, when it could have been quite difficult here. I mean, before homosexuality was legalised. Yes. But he said that was he was never concerned about it at all. That's extreme confidence, isn't it?
It was. He was absolutely open about his homosexuality. As you say, it was very courageous because people were sent to prison, and he didn't hide it from his parents, and they just accepted it, but it was never talked about. So, I think that's it's because he was so open about it. You know, I think that had a very big effect on the whole gay scene.
Yeah. And his lovers feature very strongly in his pictures. Did you talk to him about them, or you weren't really going to talk about personal things, really, in your
life? No, I didn't really talk about his personal life, no. Other than, of course, he wrote a lot. So I read a lot of his pieces that he did a lot of journalism, writing for newspapers and things and magazines. So there's quite a lot about that he wrote in it. I don't particularly remember. I mean, I may be wrong, but it was 25 years ago I did the interviews. I talked about most things. I probably did cover it. I just forgot.
Yeah. And do you think it's right?
I'm sure I did. You know, I can't believe I didn't talk about it.
Right. Do you think it's right that the Californian pictures, particularly A Bigger Splash, are the most famous ones? Is there some strange magic to those pictures?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. They are quite extraordinary. And they're unlike anything else anyone else is doing. They are figurative, but they're very, very modern. I think just the use of colours, so they jump out at you. So, yes.
And take a huge amount of work. I saw an interview just after he died, just painting the actual splash.
Yes.
I think that took about 10 days or something like that. It's much more difficult and complex than you would think.
No, yes, that's certainly, because he used to say that painting water was the most difficult thing he'd ever had to do. And actually very few artists can paint water, but it is extraordinary the way he did evoke water. But he, I watched him often drawing, just drawing trees and things. And the thing that struck me was, you know, that he just was so confident in the way he used the pencil. There was never any crossing out. He didn't need a rubber.
Right. You'd see him look and look and look and look.
Yeah, you'd just draw it. I mean, marvellous. That was a great thing to watch, actually. Watch an artist actually doing that. Because he did paint a lot outside. I mean, marvellous. In round and about the Yorkshire Wolds, he became quite a well-known figure in the highways and byways with his easel set up and his chair and his canvases and painting en plein air.
And people would stop for a chat.
Yes, they, and he loved that.
Yeah.
And painting en plein air had become completely unfashionable. And he just thought that it's ridiculous. And I think he made people put it back in fashion.
There was a good interview where it said he heard, when he was in Yorkshire, and he heard the weather forecast saying, don't go out tomorrow morning, there's heavy snow. He said, of course you've got to go out tomorrow morning because there's heavy snow.
Yes, I did once find him photographing and painting in the snow. It was marvellous.
And again, unlike quite a lot of artists, seemed to like journalists, is that right? And didn't mind you writing about him, gave you complete copy approval?
Yes, he didn't want to know anything about it. He just said, you can do it, but don't expect me to read. Don't expect me to read, he said. You can write what you want, I don't care.
That's very, very nice, yes. Actually.
That's the ideal thing to be told.
Exactly, wonderful. You'd known him a long time. You first met him in 1965, is that right?
I met him in 1965 with Sheridan and Linda Dufferin in their house at some party. My mother was there, so I remember. I was at school still, and I was just completely mesmerised by seeing this man in multicoloured, all these brightly coloured clothes. You know, led quite a conventional life in Yorkshire and then at prep school and things. And seeing this, all these gay men cavorting about in their wonderful bright clothes, it was brilliant.
And you bought a picture, I understand.
I bought a picture. Well, my mother bought me a picture at the very first exhibition he had at the Casbin Gallery, where the average price was about, for the big pictures, Two Men in a Shower was £200. And that was the one I wanted. My mother said, are you mad? I'm not paying £200 for something I could paint better. So she bought me the cheapest one in the show, which was one called Man, which is a large head on two huge legs. And it was a print. Yes, it was a print. I mean, it wasn't a drawing, but it was... Anyway, I've still got it.
And he was already a star, because I think he'd been sort of discovered by Casbin and shown at his and Sheridan Dufferin's gallery in 1963, I think. But this was 65, and already he was very well known, was that right?
Yes, well, he was beginning to be. Yes, he was. He was well known as a character, too. Yes, as in the art world. Well, when I was at school, I used to take something called Discovering Art, I think there was, and then there was various art magazines, and I used to see his pictures in those, and sort of was really interested in him. So it was marvellous to go to the Casbin Gallery and actually meet him.
How amazing. And that whole look, well, he talked about it, he'd seen something saying, blondes have more fun, so yes, like that.
Marvellous.
And that's all a confidence Very confident thing, isn't it?
Yes, very funny, that blondes. Well, you saw, yes, that was a Clairol advertisement, wasn't it? Blondes have more fun. So he immediately went and dyed his hair blonde.
And then the reinventions kept on coming, the great love of technology, which is very unusual. At first, those photo collages, which...
He was the first person, he was the first major artist, international artist, to have a show of painting done entirely on an iPad. And at the age of, in his 60s, late 60s, yeah, extraordinary.
And had earlier done pictures on faxes, hadn't
yes,
he?
Yes, fax pictures were wonderful. I remember watching him do this, because the fax paper, well, he didn't, I don't think he realised to begin with the fax paper fade, so that gave him quite a shock. But watching them come out of the fax machine was very funny.
And I think they're very good, those photo collages.
Yes, or the photo collages. He really invented the photo collage idea. And they are extraordinary, they're amazingly complex. I mean, I'm a photographer, but I tried to do something like it once, and I didn't get anywhere near it. I couldn't understand how to do it. You have to have an incredible knowledge of perspective to do things like that.
And actually, he said, that famous one, which is in an American desert, you think, well, it's quite simple, you take lots of pictures, put them all together, but he said he kept on doing particularly the sky, with whatever it was, 100 photographs in it.
Yes.
And he said, so you're essentially painting with pictures, really.
Yes, they are amazingly complex things. Wonderful.
Yeah, and he had this theory about early artists using lenses to project pictures.
Yes.
Did he talk to you about that?
That was a pet theory.
And did you agree with the theory?
Well, I don't know, really. I think it was his theory. It was, and he loved it. He really did not like it. He used to get very, very cross with people who disagreed with it. Personally, I think it's slightly stretching it to think that early artists I'm not sure I go with it myself, but
and he made these, he spent these long periods in Yorkshire and then finally in Normandy, and obviously he's from Yorkshire, so that's a reason to go there.
Yes.
But it's always in search of light, and I think in Normandy in search of particular types of blossom. There was more blossom in Normandy than in Yorkshire.
I mean, what he loved in Yorkshire was the big skies. That was his best. That's what really kept him there. I remember him saying that. I just loved the big skies. And the light in Yorkshire, of course, is a very special kind of light. And the Normandy, yes, it's wonderful seeing those incredible paintings of trees that he did there.
And you talked to him, you got a lot of interview time with him, and he was happy to talk about anything, was he?
Anything, yes. I've got hours and hours of tape, which I don't know what I should do with it, actually, because it ought to be kept somewhere. I should give it to somebody.
Oh, certainly should go to an archive,
because I don't have a lot. I mean, I've got my own archive, but it ought to go. Is there a hot in the archive somewhere?
Well,
I should give
be.
It to them all.
There must be,
yeah.
And so you ended up knowing him for, 60 years.
I met him in 1965, but got to know him when Linda Dufferin brought him to tea with myself and my wife in, would have been 2004, when he just moved up to Bridlington. And she rang up and said, I'm at the bottom of the drive with David Hockney, can I bring him to tea? And I said, yes, please. And he came, and he literally never drew breath for 2 hours.
And talking about what?
Just talking about everything, the beauty of the worlds, the skies, the light, painting, the wonders of painting, how he loved watercolours, going back to painting watercolours. I mean, by the time he left, my wife and I were completely exhausted, but more than that, we were totally inspired to sort of go out and paint ourselves.
Just
thought what an incredible man he was. I'd never really met anybody like that before, who just sort of poured enthusiasm out.
Yes, and as we said, very, very funny as well.
Yes, he was very funny.
And the comparisons are invidious, but I think he certainly was a genius. Do you think he was the greatest British artist of the last 60 years?
I think so, definitely, yeah. Yes, I can't see there's anybody to compare with him, really. And because he had a wide scope. I mean, he was a brilliant draftsman. I mean, he did very good pencil portraits.
Oh, they're brilliant, those ones of and pen of Auden in the late 60s. Yes. And they're fantastic. Yes.
Yes, I mean, he went back to doing those funny watercolour portraits that I don't particularly like them, but in his last years of all his assistants and that kind of thing. But they're quite amusing. I mean, they really just showed that he was very skilled.
Yes, and did you see him do those? Those are extraordinary. Those very simple pen or pencil drawings of people like Auden.
Yeah.
Could he just, well, I would say, could see someone, could do it almost instantly?
Yes. Yeah. Now that was a great skill.
Well, yes. That's a very good place to stop, and thank you so much to Christopher Sykes for appearing on Radio Aldi talking about the late, great David Hockney.
Good. Well, it's been a great pleasure.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.